Good. Okay, nice to see everyone again. Really, really delighted to be having a conversation with Paramatha. We've had a few of these over the last, have we had one or two of them together?
Possibly two. Yeah. Certainly one in London.
Yeah,
in another context.
Yeah. So I just basically I take every opportunity these days to try and mine Paramatha for jewels. He has a mine of a treasure, I think. So what we'll do is I've got a few questions I'm going to ask Paramatha, and the theme is Bhante and Bhante's teachers at a time with the whole theme of our retreat, and we'll see how that goes. If I run out of questions, I might open it up and see if you've got any questions. But in any case, we'll finish around 5, the first bit, then we'll have a little break, and then Paramatha's going to take us on a tour of Ergyen House.
Oh,
yeah, after that. So we move the tour to here. Here we are. why I think you're a mine of jewels. Well, really, because you spent so much time with Bhante. I know others did as well. But can you? I've forgotten myself how long you spent with Bhante. It was in a few stints, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I suppose in the 30 odd years I've been in England, 20 of those was living with Bhante, roughly. So the first tour of duty, as I call it, was 9 years, from 89 till about 96, 97, when we went on tour around the world, America, Australia, New Zealand. And then I was down in London, and then when Nitya Bhandu decided to go to Krakow and set up the centre there, I offered to come back and be Bhante's, whatever the term is, companion. That doesn't seem quite right, but look after Bhante, basically care for him. And that was 2008 till he died at Addis Dhana on October, late October 2018. So it's quite a sizable chunk of my time in England, living with Bhante, Madra Maloka, Addis Dhana.
Well, it's quite a sizable.
Shikavati.
Yeah, it's the size of a chunk of your life or anyone's life, 20 years, isn't it?
Yeah. And even between, we kept up. It would always be, even when I was down south, it would always be Saturday evening. You have an exciting life as a Buddhist on Saturday evenings. Bhante would always ring on a Saturday evening, so we'd always keep connection and he would come and visit me wherever I was, and we'd go for little outings. Yeah. I remember, anyway, we don't need to get into reminiscing about me. Where I was living was Beaconsfield, just outside of London, and actually Milton's house that he was given during the plague, he was given it by one of the Quakers, Fox, I think it was, may have organised him a place to get away from London during the plague, but it was where he wrote Paradise Lost, or a good chunk of it, dictated it to, he was blind, and dictated it to one of his daughters. So, yeah, quite moving to be in that little room. And probably our signatures are in the visitor's book. So even in between those two periods, I did see quite a lot of Bhante, and I'd always take the opportunity to come up to Madra Maloka, particularly when he had his bout of insomnia back in that period where he could. So a lot of time with Bhante, essentially.
That's good. So given that the theme is Bhante's teachers, So let's just start quite broadly, because Bhante said he had many, many teachers, actually. And he said, he talks about his parents as being his first teachers, and that being the tradition. And I notice when you go to Ergyen House now, he's got a photograph of his mother and father, hasn't he?
Yeah, that's interesting, actually. I discovered something a few days ago. Well, firstly, we discovered this document called What I've Learned from My did he use the word teachers or gurus? I'm not sure. But they include his mother and father and some of his Tibetan teachers and even some of the Hindu teachers that he met. And what he's done is he's which I thought was quite extraordinary, actually, he's distilled in a couple of lines what he learnt. Yeah. So I thought, wow, I don't know if I, it would take quite something to really do that for all the people that have significant influence on me in my life, just to distill a couple of lines. I don't remember them, the words, but I think from... I remember talking about Jamyang Kensi, who regarded as a sort of root guru, I think, that he realised his mind was fundamentally pure. So... or something in that, in those words, which I thought was interesting, actually. Yeah. So, but you know, for each, for many of the teachers, he has a couple of lines worth reading. But that was an unfinished document. That was just a manuscript that we came across, which was really interesting.
Yeah, and we'll see that when we go to Arabian Heights.
Yeah. But and the pictures of his mother and father, I don't know whether you know, but that appliqué white tara. Probably most of you were, was not from Dada Rinpoche, his teacher. It came from Dada Rinpoche's previous incarnation. So it's got some age. It's probably a couple of hundred years old, I would imagine. But I was reading a diary from, I don't know, maybe 2016, and I'd forgotten all about this. Bhante had a dream where I was putting up pictures on his wall. And the middle picture was Lady with an Ermine, which was one of Bhante's, I think it's Sadnandi. You must have done an interview with him. I think it's mentioned there with Lady with an Ermine.
We're often sitting in front of it.
Yeah, and in the dream I'm putting up this figure of Lady with an Ermine, Leonardo, and a picture of his mother and father either side. And I'd completely forgotten that. And it must have been... after you recounted that dream, maybe even 6 months, a year later, suddenly he asked Buddhadasa to put a picture of his mother and father either side of this figure. It wasn't the lady of, you know, with the Ermine, it was White Tara. But I thought, actually, this was only last week, I thought, well, that's quite representative of Bhante, actually, and an influence through Khatri Rinpoche, because he would often act on... either spiritual experiences or dreams, and without telling anybody, actually, quite quietly, suddenly things would appear in the flat, and you just thought, oh, right. So I only sort of discovered that the other day. I thought, well, maybe the other reasons, but it was a bit like you know, when we bring up the refuge dream of mother and father right beside. So. He actually, maybe the dream prompted him, you know. But that, I thought that was an interesting, and he, other things as well, you know, in that regard.
And would he talk to you much about his relationship with his parents?
He had a lot of dreams. I mean, dreams were often where Bhante had, he'd often had big dreams, and particularly when he was ill, and sort of dreams that contained... spiritual, what I'd call spiritual experience, sort of visionary nature. Sometimes his family, his whole family, in fact there's a poem, isn't there, that's based on a dream, the family reunion. Everybody's transfigured in this wonderful way. I thought it was a really delightful poem. But he'd often be visiting tea shops with his mother and eating cake and drinking tea. Sometimes he'd recount that. Yeah, I think his father as well. He had quite a strong feeling for his father. I got the impression he would have liked to have spent more time with his father. He recounted a few times where he swore at his father. I mean, back in the 20s or 30s, it would have been, oh, damn you, or something like that. But it was a source of regret for him, actually. I think it was something that was quite tender in his sort of conscience, you know, that episode, he remembers it and regretted it for most of his life. And I think it seems to be the case when you get older that, you know, these, the, you know, the parents, they're so deep, aren't they, in the DNA, in the conditioning, that a lot of people experience that. I know my partner works in care, and quite often people will be asking for mother or father, or, you know, have experiences around their parents. It was obviously different with Bantu, but there was something of that. Quite a lot of talking about mother and father, quite a lot of dreams.
I was thinking about that document because I was thinking about seeing it in we will see it in our Urgin House. It's quite playful as well, isn't it? He's got guru masala dosa in it as well. Still on the theme of teachers in general, he talked about in that last or second last paper he wrote about the Garva Sutta. He talked about, he said, "I've always looked up," didn't he? I mean, how did that sort of manifest in your experience?
Well, I think when I first met Bante, in a way, a lot of our conversation was sort of indirectly or directly coming from influences from his teachers. He talked quite a lot about his teachers. In fact, I think, looking back, I think most of the stories and precious teachers he sort of relayed at that time. Mm. And I probably was quite interested at the time. And he seemed to thread into my involvement, his involvement with me, elements of that as well, because I think I was doing quite a lot of prostration practices at the time. I remember him talking quite a bit about Katsu Rinpoche. Katsu Rinpoche, if you remember, was the one teacher that really took a personal interest in Bante, especially. I remember Bante saying he had this really lovely combination of warmth and masculinity, and took him on in a way. And I think that was, he was a friend in the way that his other friendship with Dada Rinpoche wasn't quite the same. I think there was a thread of communication that we had around Katsu Rinpoche. And I think Bante's involvement with me was in a way developing a friendship by sort of studying and talking about the things that put me in contact with my sort of higher self or spiritual self. Mm. So after coming back from ordination, we did that sutra on the study on the Sutra of Huainan, but we also, I remember sitting in that front room, that little sort of Victorian sitting room that Bante had set up in Padmaloka, do you remember that, the front room, and reading The Life and Liberation out loud. It was his idea. I've just got these memories of the conversion of Black Salvation, which I think will remain with me till death, probably, Tapa Nagpo. And you remember that one? Oh. But yeah, I think in a way it seemed a bit initiatory, in the sense that, you know, to read the whole Life and Liberation, it's not so much just reading, it's how Bante reads it. And I think that's the thing that's difficult to talk in these contexts about, you know, Bante, his teachers. They're all of a piece in a funny sort of way, because he definitely saw each of his teachers as being reflections, as being associated with Buddha and Bodhisattva figures. Katsu Rinpoche, Padmasambhava, Dilgo Khyentse Amitabha, Jamyang Khyentse Manjigosha, Dada Rinpoche, White Tara. He definitely made a... and I think Bante's mind, he's always said he had a medieval mind, you know, that he saw reflections and correspondences and things. And so I got the sense that there was that element going on with his teachers as well. Mm. So when we first went to London after, this was in 1989, he decided, and I suspect this might have been for my benefit more than anything, to start formally meditating again. So he did quite a lot of practice, and then every month, guru yoga and mandala offerings, and very much centered around Padmasambhava. And that little flat off Officer Carmody, which was, you know, for me, it was... the image I thought of the other day was it's like this little planet trying to come into some stable orbit around a giant planet, you know. Either you get sucked into it completely or get spun off into empty space. There's that sense of, you know, the communication and also... You know, we went to Tutankhamun for a sort of 2-3 weeks. I can't remember how long, but Jamyang Khyentse. It was Dudjom Rinpoche. He used to talk about Vajrasattva a lot, so we did a lot of Vajrasattva practice in that 2-week period. Again, I don't know why, but whether it was just for me or for him. But it certainly had a huge effect on me. It was a slightly disintegrating effect in a sort of positive way. I just, you know, because I'd only been in England a year, six, you know, I was young. I'd just come off Gugi Loka, 27, 28. But yeah, really, I think. When he used to talk about his teachers with me, at least you get the stories. But the thing that's difficult about Bhante is that, you know, a lot of the communication was sort of non-verbal almost. You know, it wasn't sort of as if he was talking about. He'd say something that would just carry such meaning and weight. And I think at the time it had a big effect on me. I couldn't quite separate Bhante out from his teachers sometimes. Dada Rinpoche particularly, because that was the year before he died. And he talked quite a lot about Dada Rinpoche and his friendship, actually. Yeah. I don't remember the details, but he did communicate something of his connection with Dada Rinpoche quite powerfully, actually. It was an interesting time, that early part. So had a lot of information about his teachers and a lot of sort of, I don't know what you'd call it, sort of communication around that level. So it was quite a visionary time in some ways that year, the first couple of years. And, difficult to talk about. But, I was having all sorts of extraordinary dreams and visions around some of his teachers as well. And I think in a way it was, I don't know, I still don't understand it, but I think it was being in that very intense atmosphere with Bhante, and he was just getting on with his writing. And actually to link in with this thing that just inspired, you know, it was a real sort of hum. He was doing what he loved. He was writing. So a very routine life, but quite extraordinary. And then later in his life we talk quite a bit about his teachers. I've forgotten your question anyway.
Well, it was about Bhante saying, it doesn't matter, it was about Bhante saying that it was natural to him to look up. And just, you know, it was just imagine you saw that in him, you know.
I sort of felt that, in a way that reverence was sort of very tangible, embodied, very visceral, very sort of part of his life, the way he communicated himself. I think that's what I meant. But he'd quote Goethe, he'd say, quite often he'd say, he'd come out with he'd have a few quotes he'd come out with them, but Goethe said, happy is the man can fathom the fathomable but quietly revere the unfathomable. And in a way I got the sense with Bhante, he wasn't very sort of, he wouldn't talk a lot about his devotion, he's not that sort of person, but on one level it was there, you could feel it, there was a sense of it. Quite often, and I probably wasn't the most mindful, but what I did notice about Bhante was that he'd always have pictures of his teachers there, that there'd always be a shrine that was kept up and little offerings, and you know, you might ask me to dust it from time to time, but that was a sort of a live thing, I think, even right through till as death, actually. If you look at the shrine, there's a certain sort of so that looking up. Mm. I think you could feel it in a way. You could feel it. Mm. Yeah, it was quite strong.
And I had another question, but I think you might have anticipated it, because I was very struck, in the paper on the Garva Sutta, that when he talked about each of his teachers, in the same sort of breath, he was talking about the practice he's received from the teacher.
Yeah.
And I'd read something previously in a seminar the other way around, where he said he never would... He didn't practice, say, the White Tower of Sadhana without thinking of the teacher who'd given him each one.
That's right.
And they were completely inseparable. I remember that had a big effect on me.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah.
You know, so that medieval mind element is sort of, his sort of living spaces were always a bit of a mandala, but quite know why something was there.
Yeah.
But in his mind, there was a whole web of associations and... like, for example, I remember having a conversation with him about Amitabha and Dilgo Khyentse. It was exactly that.
Yeah.
And then the next day, a little Amitabha appears above the chair I sit in the lounge.
Oh, right.
Unannounced. Right. So, and I didn't bother asking, but why did you put that? But, I'd forgotten those conversations. Yeah. But after, a week, I thought, oh, yeah, he's done that, because we had this quite important conversation. Yeah. So, in a way, there's a lot in the flat that's put there with a certain sort of intention.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got an associative symbolic...
Yeah.
He sort of lived in a very symbolic sort of world, in a way, on one level, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely... in terms of his practices. And Dilgo Khyentse was interesting, actually, because he was the one that gave him the Poa practice, so I did ask him quite a bit about that. But someone else had said, well, why didn't you pass on the Poa practice? And he said, well, I did write about fidelity, which I found really interesting, actually. I think he had a fidelity to his teachers and in a way that, I think what he meant by that is, the power is about transference of consciousness and at the time of death, and, it's in a way it's articulated quite a technical way of staying in touch with your yidam or what is representative of reality. But I think that's what he meant, that really the practice is based on the principle of fidelity to one's teachers and the ideal, or whoever represents that connection with reality. It's quite interesting. And I think I remember back in when we first met him talking about Green Tara and the fourth Lakshana, actually, or the fourth Lakshana. But it was interesting that the latter part of his life he wrote that paper on Green Tara and the fourth Lakshana. Maybe he was just talking about beauty and back then in the fourth Lakshana. I remember that was quite strong, which is no surprise. His favourite, his most influential non-Dharmic book, apart from poetry and literature, was The Symposium. So it's always been a theme, hasn't it, with Bhante, and that sense of hierarchical levels of beauty.
I was thinking about his teachers. He clearly wanted us to know his teachers, didn't he? We're writing precious teachers, giving that talk on his eight teachers, having the special photograph of them. I was sparked off by just a chance conversation that we had when we were talking in the exec. I don't know how we had it. This is what gave me the idea for this interview, that you happened to mention that the fact that our precepts are framed in terms of purity, that came from Dujong Rinpoche. And I just thought, oh, like I never knew that. And I don't know if you could say any more about that, and also any other influences that you direct influences.
Yeah, I think much to my regret, I did ask him what he thought the influences were with each of his teachers, but I've lost those notes. But I'm sure he said to me at one point that, the writing of the positive precepts, that basis on purity, I'm pretty sure that he took that from that emphasis on purification from, Vajrasattva, associated Vajrasattva with Dujong Rinpoche, actually. So that sort of percolated in, I mean, it'd be interesting. I really can't remember. It's probably one of the things. I'll regret a lot of things, that I haven't bothered to put down or remember, but that was certainly one of them. One could almost guess, I guess, the influences from each of the teachers.
What would you guess?
Well, I think, with probably Dada Rinpoche, Dada Rinpoche's motto has become, in a way, quite important in the movement, isn't it? Cherishing the Dharma. He said at one point that his friendship with Dada Rinpoche was, I don't know where he said this, but it was based on mutual respect. He found, he said it was really important in friendship to have an element of mutual respect. But he thought that the relationship was based on the fact that each of them realized how much they cherished the Dharma, something like that. Cherishing the Dharma. Mutually. I don't know, actually. I'd be interested what others think about how each of the teachers have filtered into the movement or had an influence. That was just one tangible sort of thing that he mentioned.
Okay, well, maybe we can come back to that. I wanted to, this is a slightly different tack, and I remember reading this for the first time in Banti's memoirs, and it's people remember the incident. It's there's a meeting with Allen Ginsberg and Yogi Chen and Banti. And Yogi Chen's talking about all the tantric sexual practices. And Allen Ginsberg suddenly gets a bit excited and says, could you do it with a boy? And Yogi Chen's absolutely horrified by this. And Banti, I remember this, well, obviously there's quite a lot you can make of that little incident. Banti said that he thought that was rather a narrow view or something, that you couldn't. And I thought, it was the only time I ever noticed that there's something, I mean, the word criticism would be too strong, but there was a slight, there was definitely a divergence of what they thought, and I wondered if, I don't know, like just did Banti ever, have any criticism or anything like that, or any disagreement with any teachers?
Yeah, the way I remember that story was Allen Ginsberg, might be wrong, but I think it's true. Allen Ginsberg and Banti walking up to Mr. Chen's apartment. Allen Ginsberg asking Banti, saying, "Why don't you ask him?" I think that's part of Banti's trickster. see what happens when he does ask him. He probably knew darn well what was going to happen. I don't think about he had no criticisms or differences of opinion or per se, but. With his teachers, I don't think, but he was quite critical of Tibetan Buddhism. I've just come across a thing in his diaries, 54 things for the new Rinpoche, which must have been written in the 1950s, early 1950s, or mid-1950s, something like that. He's going through some suggestions for the new Rinpoche, and he's obviously been exposed to Tolkus that he wasn't terribly impressed with for various reasons. So he's given them 54 separate instructions on which I thought was quite interesting.
What kind of thing?
Not just, rely on your status to take in offerings without teaching. I mean, it'd be nice to read them out. I can't remember them offhand, but it did strike me that somehow there was a bit of a template there, maybe for order members, you know, Dhammacharis, Dhammacharinis, in a different way. But he's obviously thinking about, because there were things that he was bumping into, obviously, in Kalimpong that... I mean, for one thing, for example, there was the sectarianism. And obviously he was trying to work against that. So quite actively, I think, I said to him once, did these guys get together across the divides? Like, I seem to remember saying to him, did Khatri Rinpoche ever spend time with Dada Rinpoche? And he said, no, I don't think so. But he said, but I did get them all on the same platform at some point. And I think he was doing that quite consciously. I think Trungpa Rinpoche, one of the Dalai Lama's teachers, visited Kalimpong. So he managed to get the Gelugpa and the Nyingmapa lamas, the Tulkus, up on the same stage. And it's not a criticism, but he would, you know, certainly with Dada Rinpoche, as far as I know, some of you have met Dada Rinpoche, he would... I wouldn't say exactly instruct him, but on giving lectures, because in the Tibetan system they didn't give sort of lectures in the Western sense. It was a very sort of polite form of, I think they call it kamung or something, and it wasn't very, although it was polite, it wasn't very palatable. But I think Bhante's influence on Dada Rinpoche was to encourage him to give proper lectures, which was very well received by the Tibetans. And Bhante could be, Dada Rinpoche could be quite outspoken because, you know, the Chinese invasion. So I think that's something that was an influence through Bhante to Dada Rinpoche, you know, so it was both ways. Also, I think he said, I can't remember if he said to me or somewhere else, that he listened to Dada Rinpoche. Dada Rinpoche had some really bitter enemies. Not everybody, you know, was, you know, sort of enamored or loved Dada Rinpoche. He had some really bitter enemies that were trying to get him arrested in Kalimpong, the Indian police, or send him back to Tibet or China, as it was. But according to Bhante, Dada Rinpoche is very clever. He's always one step ahead. So they used to have a bit of a laugh about how they'd outfoxed. He always managed to stay ahead of that. But, I get the impression their friendship was based on, you know, quite a... You get the impression, anyway, that, you know, that communication was quite deep, two-way communication. But the reverence, you know, obviously Bhante regarded him as a bodhisattva. There was always that sort of vertical element that came across. But yeah, he had criticisms. I don't know whether I never heard him criticise his teachers or anything. But he would have differences of opinion, no doubt. I can't think of any examples, but there were things that he wouldn't agree with, no doubt.
That's interesting what you said about the relationship with Dada Rinpoche is like our model of Kalyana Mitrata, isn't it? With that reciprocity. But still with the reverence, still with the clear that he was looking up to him.
There was a period in the early 80s where Dujon Rinpoche came to Europe, or in the 70s actually, I think, wasn't it? Dhammarati, you might know, in the LBC. Someone was sent to invite Bhante to meet up with Dujon Rinpoche. And I think that Bhante found that really, really painful because the movement was really new. It was very, you know, I think this was probably 71 or 72. And he decided that he wouldn't invite Dujon Rinpoche over for the reason that, you know, it would add another element and sidetrack things over here. Yeah. Okay. But the way he communicated, he found it really conflicted and painful. And of course, the Kagyus were the first to sort of get a foothold, as far as I understand, in Europe, and became quite successful, but he didn't follow up on those connections. For the sake of sort of, you know, what he was trying to do here. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, but I remember him talking about that later in his life, and it being quite painful, actually. Yeah. But he did say that he did say to me that, you know, earlier on, that his connection with Dada Rinpoche, I remember him saying this, his connection with Dada Rinpoche was stronger after 30 years, despite the distance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm.
But he was quite affected by his death.
Mm.
Yeah.
Can you say, I was going to ask you about how he felt when his different teachers died.
Yeah, well, Dada Rinpoche certainly. That was obvious. And Dilgo Khyentse, that was interesting because I always had this impression that I'd convinced him to do an Amitabha seminar retreat, but actually looking back, I now realise that he was taking the opportunity to mark Dilgo Khyentse's death. So the last day of the Amitabha retreat, we did at Waterhall years ago, was the date where Dilgo Khyentse would have been cremated.
Mm.
I don't know whether that was explicit at the time, but again, you know, it was obviously a sign of respect and marking something quite important.
Mm.
And then, of course, he did it at a memorial for Dada Rinpoche a year later after his death, an anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
Seem to remember.
Mm.
But yeah. Chatral Rinpoche, I'd seen Chatral Rinpoche. I think it was slightly different with Chatral Rinpoche. I don't think Bante spent a lot of time with Chatral Rinpoche. But yeah, it was certainly marked in its own way.
Mm.
Yeah, I remember talking to him about that.
And when you say he was affected strongly by Dada Rinpoche's death, what was the effect?
I think, you know, it's not some... Well, whatever he said at the time, it was just full of feeling and, you know, it was just, I seem to remember very deep communication. He talked a lot about Dada Rinpoche. And probably reminisced about his time with Dada Rinpoche. But yeah, I think it was just how he said things. And I think there was some... Because it was quite strange, Dada Rinpoche... It was a difficult year in the Tibetan calendar astrologically. 73, I think. So it was a bit mysterious, him dying at exactly 73, because he'd gone on a pilgrimage to make merit, and there'd been communication between Dada Rinpoche and Bante in the months prior to his death, some correspondence. So he talked quite a bit about that, actually. I think there was a sense that Bante thought that Dada Rinpoche may have had some intention for dying then. I don't know. There was a sense of that. Something slightly mysterious in the background, actually. Which sort of came out at that time, as far as I remember. Which surprised me sometimes. I remember Bante saying something like, I wonder why... He wouldn't have said it like this, but... Ah, yes, okay. Dada Rinpoche's, he's died. Yeah. Well, you know, and, you know, it was that sort of thing, and you think, there's something here, you know. I'm not going to ask him. Just would seem inappropriate, but, he could see some patterning or something, and I just thought, well, Dante was often like that.
And then earlier you talked about dreams. Did he then dream about his teachers?
Yeah, well, that was something that I think has all the way through, probably, I came across in a diary of his, 1964, so it must have been the time he was decided to come back to England. He wrote that he had a 11 p.m. had an intellectual vision of my guru, Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche, the late Jung Young Kensi Rinpoche, I remember the wording, an intellectual vision, and his face was shining, and I felt great delight or something. And it confirmed some of the things, some of the resolutions, something like that. It made some resolutions, so it confirmed that. So quite often, Bhante's life, it seems, there are critical points. There was another one where he was in Norwich Hospital and he recorded a dream. And it must have been around that time he had his prostate operation. And he said he was composing some verses of praise to Dada Rinpoche, but he only got as far as the third verse, and he just burst into tears and devotion and love. I thought that was interesting because, in a way, that word often happened. When he decided to hand over responsibility for the order, he talks about, doesn't he, dreaming of each of his teachers over this course of a week. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, that's extraordinary. Mm-hmm. When you think about it, with each of his teachers, he took that as a confirmation. And, you know, again, it's sort of these resonances of Khatri Rinpoche. He took his... because he also saw his vision in the cave, Amitabha, as confirmation of his resolve to get ordained, didn't he? So, again, these signs... He would interpret things in a certain way. But he would have a lot of dreams about his teachers. I remember one in particular. Dilgo Khyentse was sitting up on the stage, and there were whole groups of monks and tulkus. And Dilgo Khyentse said, who supports the Majjhimaka? And Bhante said that most of the monks put their hands up and a few of the tulkus. And then Dilgo Khyentse said, who supports the Yogacara? And he noticed that most of the tulkus put up their hands and only a few of the monks. So make of it what you will. I don't know what that means. But it was quite interesting. He had these rather enigmatic dreams with his teachers. Not only his teachers, he'd have these. I remember him saying at that period he had a dream that was of two halves. One, he was arguing with the Dalai Lama around some sort of point on Tibetan Buddhism and criticism. And then the second part of it, he was arguing with the Pope. He said something like, and the Pope was very upset. He said, well, that's only going to lead to schism in the church. And Bhante said, yeah, but there's always been schism in the church. Even from the first century AD, there was schism in the church. What are you on about? So I thought, yeah, my dreams are far more prosaic. I'm not arguing with the Pope. But in one sitting, arguing with the Pope and the Dalai Lama, I thought it was quite funny. But yeah. In the Hegelian way, apparently, I seem to remember him saying, which I don't know what that means. Hegel, this philosopher, but he'd often come out in some manner. Yeah, dreams and sort of when he had his insomnia. This is a bit off point, but so. He said, he'd often have this experience where he was just too tired to think. Because I'd often ask him about this. What's your experience like, when you're suffering so much? Mm-hmm. And so, well, the brain just switched on, can't think. I remember one day he said to me, this is a wonderful opening, he said, I just had this thought. It's easy to see the emptiness of the unconditioned and the conditioned. I remember him saying, I'm saying easy in the relative sense, of course. And it's easy to see the emptiness of the conditioned in the unconditioned. But to see the difference or distinction between the conditioned and the unconditioned as empty, that is very difficult. I said, so where did that come from, Bhante? I said, it's just sort of floated like a cloud through my empty mind, you know. And I said, really? He said, yes, but I haven't got to the emptiness of emptiness, have I? And I go, wow. So it's like occasionally, you know, you'd be, you know, taken away. Some of these little things that don't relate to his teachers. But in that period, the depths of his reflections, you know, that stuff going, even in illness, there's something undercurrent that's still going on quite strongly. But, yeah, I'm trying to think of other things that he said about his teachers.
Should we see if Anup just got any questions?
Yeah.
Anup, did you got any questions? Yeah, Maitreyi?
Yeah, I'm just interested with what you were saying about there's a difference in friendship with Khatri Rinpoche and Dada Rinpoche, because certainly for myself, I hear much more about his friendship with Dada Rinpoche as having been a real friendship.
Dada Rinpoche.
Dada Rinpoche, like a real friendship. And so I'm wondering what it was about Khatri Rinpoche that was different. I mean, you've also said that friendship with Dada Rinpoche was very much based on mutual respect.
I think they were just very different types of relationship. I think Bhante said that his friendship with Dada Rinpoche started from a, you know, came about very gradually. He was asked to put together a talk. He didn't know if he had enough content, which is quite curious, because he said, well, it was a very sort of steady, sort of sober relationship that he had with Dada Rinpoche. Nothing really much happened. It wasn't a love affair or anything of that sort, you know, no big bust-ups coming together. So. But actually, I think the big thing was when they did that tour of the sacred sites, they got to know each other. I think that's when the friendship really deepened into something else. I think Bhante makes the point that, you know, that friendships, there should be a certain amount of distance, and there's something around that self-respect, that mutual respect. It's not a love affair type thing. It's something different, and it builds and deepens. I'm sure he's been recorded saying something like that. But also, he listened to Dada Rinpoche's difficulties a lot, I think. I get the impression. No doubt, Dada Rinpoche, yeah, I mean, there's something good. I think he made a big point about cherishing the Dharma, from what I remember, that there was mutual respect based on that mutual recognition that both of them cherished the doctrine deeply, and they could see that in each other. I get the impression with Khatri Rinpoche, it was quite a different, he'd sort of taken Bhante on, I seem to remember that he must have spent quite a lot of time with Khatri Rinpoche and Dudjom Rinpoche, because he would often say, he'd be in the context of Khatri Rinpoche talking quite a lot about Dudjom Rinpoche, about meditation and things like that, talking about, you know, highest yoga tantra, Adi yoga and Maha yoga. But it was obviously he was in that sort of circle of teachers and friends, if you like, in one, and then Dada Rinpoche in another context, but they're very different. Khatri Rinpoche seems to have been a completely different sort of character, but had a real personal engagement, and maybe that was something that Bhante needed, and at that time, you know.
So it sounds like more of a kind of an Egypt relationship.
Yeah, and as I say, quite a lot of strong feeling, I think he said. A lot of strong feeling for Bhante, sort of took him on. And I think there's a relationship between Khatri Rinpoche and Jamyang Khyentse. It was almost like that you know, he was somewhere in that mix, Jamyang Kentsey, through Khatcha Rinpoche. Yeah. That's the sense I got, actually.
I'll ask you, it's a very minor question to do that. There's a photo of Bhante, Khatcha Rinpoche, Jamyang Kentsey on his chair throne, and a very young Sogyal Rinpoche, and the others in Rigpa, they airbrushed everybody else out and just left Sogyal and Jamyang Kentsey. Yeah. Did Bhante ever comment on that? I'm not sure if he even knew about it.
I don't know. I didn't comment on that. He commented on Sogyal Rinpoche and buying him a cricket bat, and said he always was a little bit of a show off, even at that tender young age. But that's all I remember comments from Bhante. But it was Bhante that commissioned the photographer for that, which I didn't know. For their series of photos of Jamyang Kentsey, so it seems a bit rich to brush them out. Yeah. Yeah. I should have asked him a lot more, shouldn't I?
Oh, well,
it's just, it's just one of those things.
And,
just
why didn't you ask?
Well, there's resonances there. But I, you know, I'll come across stuff again. I mean, it's a shame.
Bhante
having eight teachers. Was that sort of, did he define that in some way, or because it sounds like there were others?
Eight main teachers. I don't know, actually. I think when you look at that Bhante's history, there are eight main teachers, aren't there? I think there are other people that he came into contact with that could have been teachers, potentially. There was Tomo Geshe Rinpoche, not the sort of great Tomo Geshe Rinpoche that Govinda knew, but his tolku. And he had quite a special, I got the impression he had quite a special connection with him, actually. In fact, he asked me to go and see him when I was travelling in India. He'd spent quite a lot of time in a prison in the Chinese invasion, but he later in life he said he regretted not staying in contact with him. Actually, I got the impression it was quite so. There were other lamas and you know teachers that you know, but those were the most influential, I guess. Those eight, I guess. I don't know. I'm probably, some of you guys know more than me in this regard, I'm sure. It's just what Bhante communicated. I think he took quite seriously some of the instructions from his Hindu. They weren't teachers formally, but he sort of, that quality of Bhante, you know, taking on, being able to learn something, I guess, you know, from people, even God, God, you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know, and you just think, why would you waste your time there? But in a way, you know, he gave them the respect that was due and disagreed where he needed to. But he was very receptive, and you know, that's a quality with Bhante, sort of take you quite seriously. And,
Ratnaprabha then for Akasha.
Yeah. Just you mentioned how you lost some of your notes. Did you tend to systematically jot things down that
I'm not systematic.
So sometimes you did.
Sometimes I did. Yeah. I mean, in a way, it was awkward because Bhante required a certain atmosphere. He didn't want anybody tugging at his shoulder. What did you actually say? You know, so I think it was a very difficult balance. A lot of... This is the difficult thing talking about Bhante because, you know, most of the communication is... You know, they say 65% of communication is non-verbal. I think with Bhante it's 165%. So, you know, the raise of an eyebrow is a communication of momentous import. You know, or... Sometimes you'd say something and, you know, it was almost like you could see or feel. You could feel the receding tide of attention on his end. But other people feel this. I mean, it's really subtle, to the point where I remember being in Shoreditch with them walking along, and I was thinking, I wonder whether... I was thinking a question, and Bante said, yes. And the weird thing was, I didn't even bother saying, I haven't asked the question yet, Bante. It was that sort of relationship. It was really odd. I'm not saying it was like that all the time, but certainly in the early part, it was quite strange, actually.
I noticed that in Guhiloka.
Yeah.
The two of you together. There was just like a little mutter, or you were both weren't looking at each other, but there was, you were certainly in tune.
Yeah. There's a lot I didn't understand. He'd always insist I sit opposite him in meditation in the shrine, whether at Padmaloka or wherever. I didn't bother saying, Bante, what's that about?
When you're on your own or with others?
Well, when we're on our own anyway, but there was always this sense of, Paramatma's got to sit there, so there's always this sort of sense of something else going on, but I didn't dare ask him. I mean, I was fresh off the boat, wasn't I? I wasn't quite sure. I didn't know him that well, and I don't know, I was probably a bit wowed, and, he's a big man, and I just assumed there was a lot going on in the background, and actually, as it turned out, there was. But it was an interesting experience being in that. I think probably it was an integrative experience for me the first couple of years. And it got very strange, in that little flat in Sukhavati. It was strange in a good way. It wasn't necessarily bad, but it was very intense. I'd been having all sorts of out-of-body experiences and visions of things. And I think it was just that sort of weird, not quite integrated mind coming into contact with that big, planet. not trying to not be sucked into it completely, but nonetheless it was having a huge influence. So it was interesting times. But a lot that's what makes it difficult talking about Bante sometimes, because a lot of it is happening on some other level. The prosaic level is probably stuff you've already heard, but in a way it's just on another level of feeling and intuition. And
Prakasha had a question.
You mentioned reading Bante's diaries. Would you like to say anything about what he left?
What he's left?
Yeah, in terms of diaries.
Probably 30-odd diaries with various bits and pieces. They've been mined, I think, in the past. But, there's things that really stand out now, I thought this thing about, this is partly why I can remember it verbatim, it was so fresh in my mind. At 11 p.m. had an intellectual vision. Intellectual vision refers to St. Augustine. So I heard the difference between corporal vision, the vision of the eye, spiritual vision, which is more to do with perception, not spiritual in the sense that we think of it, and intellectual vision, meaning visionary experience. So there's little things like that that come out with his teachers, and the Dada Rinpoche one when he was having his operation in Norwich. But there's quite a lot of stuff there that I think would be really interesting to look at. He just had a big trunk of diaries and calendar type diaries. And some of those go back to the late 40s. Late 40s, actually.
Wow.
The diary that he took around with him in India, which he had written out. Beautiful thing. We looked at it on the Sutra of Wei Nang seminar. The whole of the awakening of faith in the Mahayana written out in this beautiful handwriting. Really stunning. Mm-hmm. And sort of carried around him with him in his wandering days. There's a lot to look at in those diaries, I think, still.
Padmashuri?
I'm going to wait a moment, it's gone, but I will just ask. When you said for instance, a time when you were walking somewhere, and he says yes to you, and you hardly know you've got a question. Would that be something that you were pondering which had deep significance, or was it just, you know, what am I going to have for supper kind of?
No, it wasn't. It was something in between, I think, those two things. I don't think there was anything particularly deep. But that stuff sort of going on all the time. I remember coming back, and you'd always see people at four. And I had just had this really... It was horrible, actually. There was a briefcase. He was talking. And there was a briefcase in his door. And I just got this really dark, dark vibe. It was hard to shake off, actually. I didn't say anything to Banta, but when he came out, he'd seen this South African guy, and he didn't even say, but there was something, about that guy that was really, I don't know what it was. He didn't say things like that. You know, there was a certain atmosphere that was coming into Banta's orbit. There was a lot of that. Everything seemed heightened and a bit, you know, this sort of vibe, psychic vibe around. So you sort of pick up, I don't think it was me being psychic, I think it was just in that orbit, as it were. But I remember him saying, yes, this guy, not a good person, you know, something like that. I think he was a bit shaken, actually. But, yeah, it's quite curious, you know, when... I think in those years when I first got to Bantu, it was like being in that sort of realm. It seemed like a different realm, and I think he was just doing so much writing and really, really in a state of inspiration, you know. It was just so palpable. So I think anybody being in that day after day for, it was only the first 4 years after that, I went to college, but 4 years was, you know. very interesting. And then it just got easier. Yeah. So it's a sort of a step change when we got to know each other, and something happened. You know, there's some sort of that sort of strange stuff. Sort of, I don't know whether it was me or him or what, but sort of something was integrated or something. Odd.
Well, probably we should have a little break now, just after five. It's really good for Arthur. It's really, thanks so much for, it's just really, it's such a thing for us to be able to hear all this. Thank you very, very, very much for, we're talking to us, actually. I know I'm the one sitting here, but you're talking to all of us. So, thank you very, very much.
Well, I apologise for any incoherence, but...
It's not at all.
Does it?
Yeah.
And actually, I don't, you know, I mean, one of the things about talking about that is you sort of inevitably have to talk about yourself as well, which is, but it is a relationship, isn't it?
Thank you.
Thank you,
Subhadrawati,
for thinking of it.
Oh, that's good.